You're reading Fin de Siècle? Yeah, that's a little hard sometimes, that book, but it's really interesting. I'll tell you now, you can skip the chapter about the artist, anybody's reading that book. We're really not going to touch on that. But the first three or four chapters are about Max Nordau, and you get a good understanding of Nordau and time and place. And then after that, he does a good piece on Jabotinsky. And Jabotinsky is a really interesting character. We're going to spend some time on Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky, the only reason why most people don't know much about him is because he died of a heart attack in 1940 at the age of 60. Clearly, he would have been elected to the Knesset, as far as I'm concerned. Actually, it was 1950 was the election. It was a provisional government first. Clearly, he would have been elected to the Knesset. He would have been the leader of the Herut bloc, which became Likud eventually. And he was Menachem Begin's mentor. So it puts
him
in.
Did he have time to write an autobiography or a memoir?
Well, he was a writer and wrote like crazy left and right. He didn't write a memoir about himself. Some of these figures did, and we're going to see a little bit of that tonight. Lilienbaum, we'll see tonight, wrote an autobiography at the age of 33. Yeah. Okay. You know, that's a confident guy, or a macabre guy, right? Right.
Verse 33 and second 33.
Yeah, God willing, right? All right. What did we talk about last week? Remember, we did end with Rabbi Yehuda Alkali, who was the Sephardi Zionist rabbi from what is now Belgrade, the Yugoslavia area. Anybody remember anything else we talked about last week?
Vilna Gaon.
Vilna Gaon and his followers who came to the land of Israel from roughly 1805 to 1815. About 500 families came in three different waves, and eventually they would set up what neighborhood?
Mea Shearim,
exactly. That wouldn't come until later, really the second generation of them. They also provided the tipping point for the Jewish community in Jerusalem in two ways. They made the city majority Jewish for the first time in many hundreds of years, and they also changed the face of the community from majority Sephardi to majority Ashkenazi. And of course, they went and then founded Mea Shearim, which is an Ashkenazi neighborhood now. Anything else? Anybody remember? Talk a little bit about Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch and modern Orthodoxy, and how that was wedded to Germany, and it saw nationalism as being loyal to the state of Germany. It was a religious response in some regards to nationalism. It incorporated them together, and he was really the founder of something that was called Neo-Orthodoxy, but is now known as modern Orthodoxy. And he remains a very important figure in modern Orthodoxy. Let me see if I've covered everything here. Vilna Gaon followers. Oh, we talked a little bit about the rise of right-wing nationalism and how that started concerning some of the Jews. And it certainly started concerning what we'll call the precursors of Zionism, which we started with last week and we're going to finish up very quickly tonight. Things were good in general for the Jews at this time, relatively speaking. Right, I think we mentioned there was Cremal was a cabinet minister in France, Disraeli, who had converted out of Judaism but considered himself to be identified with the Jewish people and was seen as a Jew by his political opponents, became the prime minister in Great Britain, and I think it was Lessing was the founder or the head of the Socialist Party in Germany, which was the German states, which was the largest political party in that region. This was a time when socialism was becoming a big deal as well. Any questions on anything from last week? No? I guess we'll get rolling then. All right. We talked about Rabbi Yehuda Alkali. Tonight we'll talk about Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. And Rabbi Kalischer is the Ashkenazi answer to Yehuda Alkali. And we'll get to some of his writings. Hey, how you doing? In a little bit. He was born in Prussia in 1795. He died in 1874. And most of these precursors were born in the time when nationalism was rising because of Napoleon, which we talked about. And they saw the ups and downs of the revolutions and the counter-revolutions. And eventually that seeped into their Jewish consciousness as well. Remember, Prussia was actually a crossroads of the Enlightenment and the reactionary forces, the conservative forces. Prussia is really primarily in what is Poland today. And Poland had been partitioned three times in 1792, I believe it was 94 and 95, between Russia, the Habsburg or Austrian Empire, and the German states. So he was really caught in a world of clashing ideologies in many regards. And I assure you that you wanted to be not on the Russian side if you had a choice between the Habsburg Empire, which was German, or the was it the German? That's right. Okay. He apparently yes.
And why didn't you want to be on the Russian side?
Because the Russians hated the Jews.
Oh, and the Germans locked us. That's good.
But it was better. It was better. The Germans didn't have official, what we'll call state-sponsored anti-Semitism, right? They had popular anti-Semitism, and it was starting to rise in some regards. But Jews at least could go into universities there, and they could live pretty much wherever they wanted, as much as I would say today Jews can pretty much live wherever they want. There are probably some areas in this country where Jews don't want to live, for sure. And, you know, I remember asking my grandfather, it's a quick story, one day he was driving me to the old Memorial Stadium for a baseball game, and we were driving through Roland Park, and I said, you know, Pop, it's so beautiful here, was it this pretty when you were a child? And he said, I don't know, I wasn't allowed in here. And that actually was one of my first sparks of Jewish consciousness. I remember it very well, I must have been 9 or 10 years old. And I said, gee, it's not what it's cracked up to be sometimes. Yeah?
And closer to home, Gibson Island.
Yeah.
I remember my wife and I were looking for a house about 20 years ago. I called because there was a house down there for sale. And the broker pretty much came out and told me, they're not letting any Jews
in. And that was only 20 years ago.
Right.
And you know, by the way, the houses in Roland Park and a lot of areas in the city still have in their deeds no Jews and blacks allowed. It's just not enforceable, and it costs too much money. You know, why pay a lawyer a couple $1,000s to change the deed to your house when it's not enforceable anyway? So there are houses all over the city that have that.
Read the book, Not in My Neighborhood.
Yeah, I haven't read the whole thing. I read excerpts of it.
By a Baltimore Sun, former Baltimore Sun
right.
reporter, who was Finnish.
Mm-hmm.
He figured that's the only way that anybody could write that book in this town.
Right. So, as bad as that might seem to us, it was much worse if you were in the Russian areas. Much worse.
Years ago, they did an article in the Sun paper, and they interviewed me, and they wanted to know why the Jews chose to live segregated, in a segregated way. And I said, well, the chief didn't have a clue.
Right, it's amazing.
And it wasn't my choice.
And, of course, by the time Jews weren't needing to live segregated, they went all over the place, you know, pretty much as quickly as they could, which is exactly what happened in Central Europe. Eventually it would happen in Eastern Europe. But in Central Europe, Jews started moving. Jews were on the move. Now, the difference was that Jews weren't a critical mass as like they were in Eastern Europe. You know, for example, Warsaw was, by World War One, was one-third Jewish. Right, and that's a pretty heavy, and is also the same way in Kovno and in Lithuania and other cities throughout the region. So when Jews are concentrated, it becomes even worse. All right, let's go on a little with Kalischer. He was an expert in philosophy. All these guys were really, really bright. And at this point, it's all guys. We don't have any women yet. We're going to get women when we get to the Zionist movement. One of the hallmarks of the Zionist movement is it's egalitarian. They do, and you'll see in Altenewa Land, Herzl has some of that. In terms of women have equal rights in there. And keep in mind, this is a time before women had the right to vote in this country. So this was really progressive in its era. He was a fierce opponent of Reform Judaism. He would eventually be opposed by other traditional rabbis because of what were to be his Zionist beliefs. He traveled throughout Germany soliciting wealthy Jews to help get money to send Jews overseas to set up agricultural colonies. We keep seeing this theme of agricultural colonies coming up in the various writings. He didn't necessarily focus on Palestine at first. He also saw the seeds of Jewish nationalism rising as the first sign of redemption. So for Alkali and Kalischer, the beginnings or the stirrings of Zionism weren't about this openness and we're all going to have equality and we're going to live great lives the way socialism was talking about, but it was the Ikvot HaMashiach, they say, the footsteps of the Messiah are going to start when Jewish nationalism gets serious, and Jewish nationalism is going to lead us to the land of Israel. All right, in 1860, he actually joined a small group, which is notable. The formal name is the Society for the Colonization of Palestine. It was started by a guy named Dr. Chaim Lurie, and Lurie's name is spelled H-A-Y-I-M and then L-U-R-I-E. He was in England, And he, too, was gathering together like-minded Jews and non-Jews to raise money to be able to settle Jews overseas. This was seen, overseas meaning out of Europe. This was seen particularly for Eastern European Jews by Western European Jews as a way to help their brethren. You get them out of Europe, which is never going to be good for them, particularly Eastern Europe, and you settle them in, you know, you don't want, it's the not in my neighborhood phenomena. You settle them in Argentina, for example. Some might go to Palestine. You settle them in all types of places around the world. In 1862, he wrote his most...
Was this a society for...
Society for Colonization of Palestine. And there's a whole bunch of societies that are going to start springing up in the next few decades with similar types of names, usually with the word settlers in them. Let me see if I can get this rolling here. In 1862, he wrote his most well-known book, and it was called Drishat Shalom, and I'm going to write that up here in a minute. Drishat Shalom was really his coming-out book in terms of Zionism. I have a translation here of Seeking Zion. It's really regards to Zion. In Hebrew today, you say Drishat Shalom to somebody. It means send my regards to you. This was the first Hebrew book published in Central and Eastern Europe that wasn't a sacred text. There wasn't a commentary on a sacred text. All these guys wrote in Hebrew. Almost all these guys knew Hebrew and German and Ladino or Yiddish and a couple other languages. That's not working, is it? Let's see.
No, because it's on pointer.
It's on pointer, so I want it on color. All right, thank you, Michelle, as always. Drishat Shalom, Drishat Zion, sorry, I said Shalom. Drishat Zion, or Drishat, or regards to Zion. It was the first book, as I said, that was published in modern Hebrew, or not. It's not fair to say modern Hebrew, in Hebrew, because modern Hebrew, in terms of the diction and the grammar, hadn't been really formulated yet. That's going to come in two decades. It declared that the redemption of Zion must begin by actions of the Jewish people. Keep in mind, does anybody remember the three oaths that ruled the Middle Ages?
Yes.
Hmm?
Yes.
All right, do you remember anything about it?
Yeah.
What?
Don't make too much trouble. You can be oppressed to a certain degree,
right,
and don't go to Israel.
Right.
Go to Palestine.
So he was responding. He was rejecting that. You start to have, because of the influence of nationalism in the secular society, people trying to get around this. And of course, he used his proof texts, and he had just a different argument. Didn't catch on right away, but you know, he did have some readers. He declared that when you started going to the land of Zion, that's when the Messiah is going to come. And this is exactly what people right up through Rav Cook, Rabbi Cook, who was the first chief rabbi of Palestine, are going to say in the more modern era. Cook was in Palestine from 1905 to 35. But that's going to be the foundation for religious Zionism. And it really, in many regards, begins right here. In 1864 in Berlin, 2 years later, he established the Central Committee for Settlement of the Land of Israel. The Central Committee for Settlement of the Land of Israel. And it was the same type of thing as Chaim Lurie's operation was. Let's start collecting some money. And what you're starting to see is efforts, at least, are starting to spring up. A couple years later, 1870, he persuaded the Alliance, which we're going to talk a little bit about tonight in a bit, which was a French group, a secular group, dedicated toward relief and rescue of Jews. He persuaded them to open an agricultural school in Palestine. The thinking was that not that people are moving to Palestine yet, but let's set up the groundwork and let's help the religious Jews who are there now be quote-unquote useful, do something with their lives other than sit and study all day. Now keep in mind, it's all religious because some of you may remember the only way to adhere to all the 613 mitzvot or commandments is to live in the land of Israel and work the land itself. For example, the Shemitah year, which we talked about in this class as well. Let me go back.
You know, all of the titles of these books, Israel is used rather than Palestine?
Yes.
We're using the terms interchangeably.
Right. They're using the language Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel.
Okay.
They're not using Medinat Yisrael, the state of Israel. They're not using just Israel, although they're talking about the people of Israel. And sometimes they say we Israel, as in the people of Israel, or Am Yisrael.
But where was Palestine used? Or
Palestine, well, it was the Turks used it.
Just the Turks.
Yeah.
The
Ottoman Turks.
Yeah, okay.
The Ottomans. Non-Jews used it as well. They would say the Holy Land. And you have in this time in England in particular a lot of Zionist Christians.
Didn't you once tell us that the first time the word was Palestina from the Romans?
Yeah.
The first time we really hear the word Palestine.
Palestina, yeah. And then it's stuck in various versions throughout the languages going down. Yeah.
It was the Philistine, right? I mean, that's the word.
I'm not sure of the derivation of the word, to be honest, so I don't want to mislead you. That sounds logical, but, you know, history. This is an excerpt of something that you have in your book, but for time, I'm going to skip over that. So I want to spend a little more time on Moses Hess. Moses Hess is a really important and interesting figure. He is the first secular person to embrace Zionism. Until now, everybody who has embraced it is religious. Everybody is validating it in religious terminology. Hess is no chump when it comes to being a figure on the scene, similar in some regards to Theodor Herzl in the years to come. Hess is extremely important, for example, in the socialist world, in ways that might surprise you. He was born in 1812. He did gain somewhat of a religious education. That was from his grandfather. His father wasn't that interested in it. His grandfather educated him. He went on to study philosophy at the University of Bonn. He was a correspondent for socialist newspapers in Paris. Many of the socialists gravitated toward Paris, particularly the German-speaking ones for some reasons. People like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels as well, who were much more well-known in those fields. Clearly, he was an assimilationist Jew. He wasn't one who was looking out for the betterment of the Jewish people. He was looking out for the betterment of mankind, in his view. And he saw that not as the best opportunity for Jews, but the best opportunity for himself as an individual. He's what we would call a Jew in name only. He turned to socialism and communism. He was actually a friend and collaborator of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. He might be, historians aren't sure, he might be the one who's responsible for the phrase, religion is the opiate of the masses. So he might be actually the one who came up with that. Again, these guys did a lot of writing. They wrote to each other. They wrote in newspapers. Periodically, they would read their works publicly. He apparently converted Engels to communism. So he was really early on in there. You know, communism didn't just spring up, obviously, in 1917. It had been active really since, with Marx's writings and maybe Hess's writings too on socialism, since socialism and communism are so related. The way it's been explained to me by somebody is that communism is more involved with the economic structure of society, while socialism is more about just a redistribution in some regards of everything and everybody being equal or having equal opportunity. In 1851, he was an ideologue, as you're going to see. His father died. He actually used the money of his inheritance to marry a Catholic prostitute because he felt that, you know, I guess he cared for the woman, but he also felt that this would be a social good thing to do. This fit with his ideology. They lived a nice, long, happy life together. So, go figure. His views started shifting in the 1850s. He became reluctant to base all of history on economic causes and class struggle. Right, this is a time when people have their ideologies challenged by one another, and every now and then they take some radical steps, as he was about to do. In 1861 to 63, he actually lived in Germany, and he saw the rising German nationalism, and it alarmed him. He was among the first to say that the new German nationalism is replacing Christian anti-Semitism, that we're going to have a nationalism with its racism deeply seated in the people emerging in other countries as well. To protest assimilation, because he started developing an identity, he said, my identity is a Jew, he changed his name to Moses. He originally was Maurice, or Moritz, but Maurice in French. He was a pantheist. I have to read this because I'd never get it straight. He believed that everything is God and there's nothing personal or anthropomorphic about God. In some regards, he was very similar to Spinoza. He wasn't religious, but he believed there was a God. And there are many people like that today in many regards. So in 1862, he publishes his Mea Culpa. It's called From Rome to Jerusalem, The Last National Problem. And we all know what that was about. Anybody guess? No, it was about Jews.
Right, but the fact that Jews were not being accepted into the new concept of nationalism.
Right. And remember, Jews were, you know, damned if they do, damned if they don't. They convert to Christianity, they're still called Jews. They stay Jewish, then they're, you know, harangued for being Jewish. But you can't assimilate, basically, is what some people were starting to say. So let's take a look at what the book says. It says, because there's a racial element to nationalism, the Jews can't assimilate. You can't assimilate. It's just not going to work, no matter what you think or say, because this racist nationalism is rising, and it's going to tell you exactly that. It says, Judaism is a nation, and the Jewish question, we remember what the Jewish question is? Anybody?
What to do with the Jews.
What to do with the Jews. And that was a question of the non-Jews. So the Jewish question is not about minority status. It's about the fact that we need our rights in another land that's our own. He says, and I love this one, he interprets all biblical laws, Shabbat, Rosh Hashanah, whatever. He says they're all socialist in their origin. So he wasn't giving up his socialism, which was really interesting. I wish I could read German to really read the original, because it's always so much deeper. The only answer, he says, is a socialist Jewish commonwealth in Palestine. And guess what labor Zionism sought to set up? A socialist Jewish commonwealth in the land of Israel. So he was really the first one to come up with what they were going to base their ideology on. He also says nationalism and universalism do not conflict. Right, I can be a man of the people for everybody and also loyal to my own people as well. So he deals with all this ideology. He's one of the first, actually he is the first, to comment on the Arabs in Palestine. Right, this has always been the question that's haunted the Zionist movement. And what the Zionist movement we're going to see in the weeks to come primarily does is it makes some statements or thinks a little bit about the Arab question, but then understandably is overwhelmed with the task at hand, which is not a small one. So he says...
So the Jewish question got traded for the Arab question.
I wouldn't go that far. Because there's really no such thing as a Palestinian question until 1948.
Have I said Arab?
Yes, I know. Well, the Arabs have other states. I better stop while I'm not ahead. You know, I don't want to go where I'm going, violate my own standards. So he basically says... The Ottoman Turks, their empire is going to dissolve, right? Anybody know the nickname for the Ottoman Empire? It was the sick man of Europe. Yeah, for about 100 years or so, it was the sick man of Europe. It really took World War I to end the Ottoman Empire. Who knows how long it could have limped along. He said France, as it did with Italy under Napoleon III, is going to support a Jewish state in Palestine, and then it's going to support Arab states in Syria and Egypt. Right? So there'll be one little Jewish state there, and there'll be other Arab states. And we believe that the Arabs should have their own states, just not necessarily in our state. So he's going to be mixing some ideologies in some regards there, too. But he's really the first one that begins thinking at all about the Arab question, which, again, is something that's going to haunt. And you're going to see in Alta Nueva Land, by the way, Herzl gives this beautiful utopian approach.
They're all equal.
Huh? They're all, and not only that, they're grateful for the Jewish state, right? Because
they
the economy is good.
Yes.
Right. Now, he doesn't say percentage or anything like that or loyalty to others elsewhere and what have you. You know, like I said, he's a pretty good storyteller, but not a great writer.
And in that time, Islam was not as radical as it is now.
So yeah, you can't even begin to compare. You can't even begin to compare because you didn't have what... Thomas Huntington called the Clash of Civilizations in his famous 93 essay.
Because the Europeans totally dominated them.
The Ottomans, you mean?
No, the Arabs.
Not yet. Soon.
The Ottomans dominated them only to be replaced by the say the British would dominate.
Well, the Ottomans didn't even dominate. The Ottomans left them alone pretty much as long as they paid a certain percentage of taxes. Mm-hmm. It was much more benign than even the Romans. They were the sick man of Europe. Mm-hmm. It was not a healthy system at all.
I'm just thinking, is Arab, maybe it's a separate topic, but is Arab nationalism or Arab terrorism now different than it was 100 years ago or 300?
Well, 100 years ago is different than 130 years ago. So let's not get into that yet. And just as a short answer, the first real problem, major problem with Arab intransigence comes in 1921 with riots starting in Jaffa. But we'll talk about that and the rise of the Mufti and all that. But this is still a time when, you know, the Arabs don't even, if the Arabs know any Jews, they're Sephardi Jews who are studying Torah all day, you know, or merchants in the bazaar, in Tunis and, you know, Rabat in Morocco and what have you. All right, so what happened with Hesse's great book, Drishat Zion? Pretty much nothing. Less than 200 copies sold. The Reform rejected it. The Orthodox wouldn't even talk about it. Everybody just said, his friends thought, he's just got a screw loose. He had to get this one out of his system. Because remember, this is an era when people just write and write and write. It wasn't until the modern Zionist movement would start, really wasn't until around 1900 that Hesse's book became popular in the Zionist movement. It became standard reading, like I said, for labor Zionists in particular. Herzl himself said, after reading it, "Since Spinoza, Jewry has had no bigger thinker than this forgotten Moses Hess." And indeed, he was forgotten in many regards by many people. Hess did not come down to become one of the famous socialists or communists. He didn't come down to be one of the famous Zionists, although we talk about him. But in 1875, he was buried in Cologne, in Germany, and his tombstone read, "Father of German Social Democracy." So he got a little bit of credit there. Then in 1961, his body was brought to Israel and was reburied in the Kinneret Cemetery, and was reburied in a cemetery that was saved for the founders of labor Zionism, like Beryl Katznelson and Ber Borachov, people who we're going to talk about.
I was at a little trouble. I mean, trying to understand him, it seems he may have been a great philosopher, but it wasn't about Zionism. I mean, it seems like he was developing this thought that man would be governed by reason and its enlightenment, mm-hmm. and religion is archaic, all religion, and
right.
We should be post-religion. And then it's not the, to me, it seemed it wasn't the German nationalism that disillusioned him, but the fact that the socialist movement, while it endorsed those views as an abstract way, it still had to be anti-Semitic. There still wasn't room for Jews.
In the socialist movement, you mean?
There was still anti-Semitic denunciations of Jews.
Right, and we're going to see that from Marx, for sure.
So you couldn't escape it. That's what he was commenting about. That's what disillusioned him, that no matter what, you could talk. It's just like, you know, here we had the Declaration of Independence, but not for women, not for blacks.
Right,
I mean,
right.
It just wasn't in the consciousness that Jews would somehow be enveloped in this rising tide of human liberty and civil
right.
rights.
Well, you're right in many regards. He was a nationalist because he was forced into nationalism due to the actions of others. And that's something that is going to happen throughout history. We're going to see that. But he is a nationalist because he says we can't fit in anywhere else. There, we can't be nothing, so we have to be something, so we have to go to the land of Israel and be who we are. But it wasn't about religious Zionism. It wasn't even about, we can contribute to the world. It's just that this is where we have to go because we don't fit in here. So it wasn't the most fully developed in some regards, but he was the first who began to develop the ideologies. That's something of note. That's something of note. But thank you. I'm going to spend a few minutes. Any questions until now? Okay. I'm going to spend a few minutes on the Alliance, as it's called. I spoke a little bit about it a few minutes ago. Let me write the full name up here.
sorry.
Allianz, Israelite. This is the one I always mess up. Universal. Which I guess is the International Israelite Alliance. For lack of better terminology, this was the first rescue and relief organization in the modern era that the Jews formed. It was formed in 1860 in Paris. And it began the pattern of wealthy Jews helping less fortunate Jews wherever they might be. And we spoke a little bit about that last week as well. What they did, they were based in Paris, as I said. They were founded, actually, after Italy's Mortara case, which is interesting if any of you ever want to read about this. Mortara of 1857. It just so happened that there was an infant in Rome in 1857, a Jewish boy. He was ill, very ill, and his... the aides in the house and the assistants, they were Catholics. They had him baptized because they thought that that would save him. He gets better. This is discovered when he's the age of six. The Pope orders the boy to be taken from the family and raised as a Catholic, which he is, and he lives a long life as a Catholic. Well, this outraged Jews who were just gaining their voice in Europe, certainly in Paris, which had been the leader in terms of the Enlightenment. Obviously, we talk about the French Revolution. Some of the wealthy Jews decided to get together an international rescue and relief organization for the Jewish people. So they would start doing things in Morocco. They would try to do things in Russia, but that wasn't allowed. They were helping out a little bit in Palestine and a couple other places. Well, in 1870, with the urging of Rabbi Kalischer and a few others, they decided to put together this agricultural school in Palestine, and it was called Mikveh Israel. Now, there's a famous American synagogue in Philadelphia by the same name. It's a Revolutionary War-era synagogue, if any of you have ever been to the American Jewish History Museum there. You'll see that it now meets there. Anybody ever been there? Yeah, it's kind of neat. They still have a Shabbat minyan there. It's not the original building, obviously. The goal was to safeguard human rights of Jews around the world, promote Jewish unity, and promote, this is interesting, to promote Jewish self-defense, which was something that was a risky business for many people. You shouldn't hit somebody as it goes unless you know you're going to knock them down, because they might hit back a little bit stronger. Today, by the way, the Allianz is still very strong in Israel. They have, I'll read off the list, a high school in Tel Aviv, Haifa, Jerusalem, the School for Deaf in Jerusalem. They have something called the Mikveh Israel Youth Village, where they have a secular school, they have a religious school, and they have a French-Hebrew high school. Because, of course, all these schools that they started initially had French as a track as well, because they thought that that was the most sophisticated language. They weren't particularly Zionist. Some of the people might have been Zionist-leaning, but they did it just to help Jews. That was the only reason why they did it. All right, a final note on the pre-Zionist period, the precursors. One of the interesting things that we also see in this time is the rise of the Hebrew novel and Hebrew literature. We have Jewish Hebrew newspapers that are coming out. Who are the Hebrew newspapers geared toward? Any thoughts? The Maskilim. Maskilim are the only ones who are able to read Hebrew, right? Unless you're a religious Jew, you can read Hebrew, but these are articles talking about how to assimilate into greater society while maintaining your Jewish identity. There was some discussion of Jewish history. This was something new and novel. So there were some Hebrew newspapers coming out, and there were some Hebrew novels. The most significant Hebrew novel was by a guy named Abraham Mapu, M-A-P-U. He wrote the first modern Hebrew novel that we have. Mapu lived 1808 to 1867. He was born in Prussia, and he lived in Lithuania. And Lithuania was part of Russia at that point, so it wasn't so easy for him to do what he did. He was a traditional Jew. He studied in Cheder. He got married at the age of 17, which was actually a little late in some regards for some people. For many years, he was impoverished. He was an itinerant schoolmaster. He would bounce from town to town. he was finally appointed to run a government school for Jewish children. The Russians did this. They said, run this Jewish school for this school for Jewish children over here, and those Jewish schools, which were government schools, taught in Russian, and they had some Jewish studies, but not that much. He was inspired by the Haskalah movement. The Haskalah movement, I have to understand, offered hope, right? It offered something that was different than what was going on with the traditional Judaism. God will provide. We will hope the Messiah comes eventually. This was a modernizing world, and these people wanted change. And Haskalah offered that opportunity. Remember, we talked about in 1881, the assassination of the Tsar and the pogroms. It ended that hope. But until then, the Haskalah had given many people great hope. He studied German, French, Russian, Latin, and Hebrew. See, that's what you get when you don't watch cable TV. Right? You can really do something. You're not texting and trying to figure out what your daughter's saying with all those abbreviations, which got me again today. So in 1853, he published a novel called Ahavat Zion, For the Love of Zion. Ahavat Zion. It's set in Jerusalem, like almost every modern Hebrew romance novel, every modern Hebrew novel from this era, and there are a number that have survived, are basically romances that took place in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem or somewhere in Eretz Israel. This was from the first temple. It was the era of King Hezekiah and Isaiah the prophet. But what's neat is it shows Jerusalem as an earthly city, not as a heavenly city. It's Jerusalem as a place where people are just living their lives. It's not about famous struggles like Bar Kokhba and Masada or anything like that. It's just a way to talk about life in the land of Israel. Book didn't sell. He was impoverished, basically broke. He wrote 6 books, and they were all on similar themes. But he's come down to us as really the first one that wrote these types of novels. And Ben-Gurion and others, as young people in the 1880s and 1890s, would read these novels, and they would be inspired by them. All right, let's see what time it is. Oh, we still got time. That's good. Before our break. That actually ends our precursors to Zion. So we're only about a week behind now, which I think is great, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you laugh. I'm serious. Too much material to cover. Are there any questions on the precursors to Zion until this point? No? I can call on people. No? Okay. All right. Let's talk a little bit about what's happened in Russia. We'll spend a lot of time on Russia because that's going to be the heartland of our early Zionist ideologues. As soon as I get this. I've got to get me one of these at home. All right. Let's talk about Russia. I talked a few minutes ago about the partition of Poland in 1792, 94, and 95. With the partition of Poland between Russia and the Germans and a couple other states, the vast majority of Europe's Jews are now under the control of the Russian Empire. Right? So all of a sudden, all the confines that the Jews have in the other parts of the Russian Empire are coming to these Jews in Poland. And these are very populous areas. The Pale of Settlement is the name of the area that the Jews live in. And just to give you, whoops, not that one, give you an indication. Yeah, we'll get to them. The Pale of Settlement. All right, so if you take a look, you know, this is Moscow over here. This is Poland throughout here. You know, you're getting to White Russia, Belarus, and all that. And it gives you a little example of what's going on there. Let me move that up a little bit. So anybody here have relatives from the Pale of Settlement? Yeah, it's not uncommon. Mine are more from the Ukraine. Lithuania is another one. Which in Lithuania is a little further up around here.
So that did not include Lithuania?
Not fully. Not fully. It just means that the Jews hadn't eked up into there. The numbers in Lithuania weren't as large as they were in other places. The learning center there, particularly in Vilna, was very, very strong. But here it's, you know, around here, it's some of it. Whoops. That's weird. Let me see if I can erase that. Yeah, I can. No, I can't.
There you go.
I just have no talents whatsoever. What can I tell you?
All right.
That, by the way, ended the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the partitions. But that doesn't necessarily mean all the Jews are there. More Jews were going to seep into Lithuania. The Pale of Settlement boundaries are going to change a little bit over the years. They're going to get smaller, they're going to get bigger, and depending on the whim of the Tsar at the moment. Life in the Pale of the Settlement, was miserable. It was very crowded. There wasn't much opportunity for any type of business that was going to make you any type of money. It was subsistence living at best.
Was part of the decision of why the Jews were forced to live in that area to separate them from the Russian Orthodox? Because that was all pretty much Catholic.
Well, actually, the Russian Orthodox and the Polish Catholics, there still were in that area. Jews had already been living in those areas when the Russians got them through the partition. So they didn't necessarily force them. Right, didn't force them to go there. It forced them to stay there. Think of it along those lines. At the same time, Hasidic courts flourished. There was great learning taking place there. There was all the fiddler on the roof type of, lifestyle, which is obviously very romanticized, that we like to think about. Raise your hand or no? Okay. The modern yeshiva, as we know it, developed there. There were yeshivas in different towns. You could send your kids to one of those towns for a yeshiva. There were large halls there that were devoted to learning, the Beis Midrash. So, I teach English at Ner Israel High School, believe it or not, during the day, and they have a Beis Midrash there, which I am sure would, be very comfortable in Lithuania 100 years ago. We'd spoken about there were some reforms in Russia. The reforms in Russia didn't hit too hard in the Pale of Settlement. They hit in the rest of Russia, primarily, because things were just so difficult there. Did we talk about the assassination of the Tsar? I can't remember. Yes? Okay, we touched on it, okay. I did mention, and I'm just going to briefly touch on it again, that the date was March 13th, 1881. He was killed by revolutionaries. One of them happened to be Jewish. That, of course, set off pogroms. That's all it took. It was a very horrible time. Numerically, by our standards today, a lot of people weren't killed, right? It was under 100. However, people were cowered into submission for, 3 days. They wouldn't leave their house. They would cower down anytime somebody would walk by. Various businesses would be torched. Houses would be burned. Fields would be burned. Animals would be taken. It was a very, very bad time to be a Jew. And periodically, pogroms would now be the norm. The next one that really is big is 1903, the Kishinev pogrom. We'll talk a little bit about that, too. A famous Zionist poem is written for the Kishinev pogrom as well, because, of course, all these attacks said one thing to the Zionists. We're right. You've got to get out of here. And historically, we know, had more people left, it would have been a better thing, obviously. Because of the assassination of the Tsar, all the reforms were canceled. And the new Tsar, this was Tsar Alexander II who was killed, the new Tsar, Alexander III, passed what are called the Temporary Laws of May 3rd, 1882. The Temporary Laws, or the May Laws, stayed in place until the Russian Revolution in 1917. That's how temporary they were. So this was the new reality for Jews. Jews were forbidden to settle outside the towns and shtetls. In fact, some towns, sometimes, you could only have a certain amount of Jews living in your town. You couldn't even move to that town. Deeds of sale and lease of real estate and the names of Jews outside the towns and shtetls were canceled. Can't own property. Can't get wealthy that way, as some people were doing. And Jews were prohibited from trading on Sundays and Christian holidays. So that's obviously to quote-unquote respect Christianity. Now, what does this mean for Jews? They can't trade and do business on Saturday, and now they can't do it on Sunday. So already they have 2 days of the week where business is taken away from them. And finally, top advisor to the Tsar, whose last name I'll never pronounce correctly, Konstantin Pobednutsdiv, said he had the famous one-third solution. A third of the Jews are going to be converted, a third of the Jews are going to be killed, and a third of the Jews are going to emigrate. That was the official policy of the Tsarist regime. Right? They didn't pass it as a law in the Duma, but this was the top advisor to the Tsar who put that in place. It's no wonder that about 3 million Jews would leave from 1881 to 1914 when World War I would stop emigration. And then in 1924, new laws that came into place pretty much stopped emigration again after a brief upsurge after the war. It's no wonder that if you could get out, you got out. Doesn't mean everybody got out. I shouldn't say that you could get out, you got out, because many stayed behind for the same reason Jews always stay, which is what?
No place else to go.
No place else to go, but not just that. This is my home. Think of the German Jews. You know, I mean, God forbid, I had to think about leaving my house because I'm Jewish, leaving this area. You know, it's my home, it's my neighborhood, it's my everything. You know, it's like the old thing of you put a frog in a pot of water and then you turn the boiler on, right? If you slowly turn it and slowly turn it, it's not going to jump out, but if you do it right away, it's going to jump out. Right? You get used to stuff. You think stuff is going to get better. After all, it was better at one point. Why wouldn't it be better again? What I want to enforce upon you is that these people had a really difficult decision to make. And there were all types of decisions, all types of options that were becoming available for them, fortunately. And it was very fortunate that Zionism and a couple other things came up when they did. Change the page here.
What did the conditions force to?
Say it again?
Or did the conditions force the growth of Zionism?
Do the conditions force the growth of Zionism? Absolutely, because every major Zionist thinker, secular Zionist thinker, which we're starting to see through Hess, says, whatever's happening here now is not working for us. There's only one place where we can be free and left alone, and that's the land of Israel. Now, some say, and that's where Jewish life is going to culture, Jewish life can grow. Others just say, that's just where we'll be. Herzl, in Altenuland, he has basically, there's one of the things to pay attention to is there's very little Jewish in that book. Right? It's a romantic approach to everybody being equal in the land of our ancestors. He even has a religious nationalist leader who he marginalizes in the book. You know, and that's clearly done on purpose because he was fighting some elements in the Zionist movement that he wanted to marginalize. He wanted it to be a movement that was open to all and had no sense of xenophobia whatsoever. And some xenophobia was going to creep in, as we see in Israel today. So anyway, that's a bit of a preview for in 2 weeks. Finally, in this era, you know, topping off the misery for Jews, this is the time when the protocols of the Elders of Zion come into being. Has anybody heard of or familiar with that?
The Russians.
In 1903, the Tsar's agents put together this false document, which basically was a report of a meeting of notes from a few years ago that the quote-unquote Jewish elders had somewhere in Europe about how they would spread around the world and dominate the economy and take over everything and, you know, take advantage and prey upon Christians. It was a tremendous hoax, which Henry Ford in this country would pick up in the 1920s and publish in his Dearborn Independent. It was clearly false, but, you know, for the peasants, they believed it. And that's exactly what the Tsar was trying to do, was to rile the peasants up against the Jews. Right? It's always an outlet. You have a question?
Didn't the protocols have to do with the blood libel?
There was There was an 1840, there was a blood libel in Damascus, which Jews didn't have any power at that point. That's actually, it's interesting, because the 1840 blood libel in Damascus is the first time that U.S. Jews petitioned the government to take action overseas. So it was an important note for U.S. Jews. But no blood libel in this. All right, so we're going to do a section now on early Russian leaders. And Russia is the Zionist leaders. Russia is the heartland of the Zionist movement. And when I say Russia, I'm including the Ukraine, I'm including Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and I'm including a good chunk of Poland, as we've seen over here. Let's see. All right, I'm gonna take a quick break right now for about 5 minutes or so, and then we're going to talk about Paris Smolenskin, and then we're going to go from there. Thank you. We are going to take a look now at three early Zionist thinkers. We are now entering the Zionist era. So from now on, it's all Zionism all the time. We're also going to look at the first Aliyah, the first wave of immigrants to the land of Israel. And we're going to take a look at something called Chibat Zion, which is the early Zionist groups that were founded in Russia primarily. And if we get a chance toward the end, we're going to talk about the fascinating character of Nathan Berenbaum, who actually created the word Zionism and Zionistic and Zionist and all that in his journal in Vienna. First person we're going to look at is Peres Smolenskin. And I have some of the writings up here. I'm not sure if we're going to go through all of them. But this is coming directly from your Hertzberg book, so it's nothing that you haven't seen before. Although, let me see. For a couple of them, I have some additional quotes. I think that this one's an additional one, but we'll go through it. All right, Smolenskin. From 1840 to 1855, he lived in a Russian city called Mogilev, Mogilev. He was a leading Jewish intellectual of his day, which is why it was all the more important for the Zionist movement that people like this would latch on to the cause. He was renowned as a 13-year-old for his Talmudic skills. Right? He, like many of the early Zionists, were raised in traditional Jewish homes, then they got caught up in Haskalah, and then they went to Zionism. So they went through various phases in their lives. You see patterns emerging. Like many, he violated school policy by reading secular works and learning secular languages, because you were supposed to do all Torah all the time. At age 18, he went out on his own, and he gained a secular education, which was unusual. He wound up in Odessa. Any of you been to Odessa? Okay, it's a sister city with Baltimore in terms of the Jewish communities. Odessa then, circa 1885 or through 1914 really, was a hotbed of Jewish intellectual activity. Odessa was very unusual in the Russian Empire. The Tsars pretty much left it alone. It had gotten it was in some negotiations and after some wars with the Ottoman Turks, and it was a relatively new city. There were Greeks there, there were Turks, there were Russians, there were Jews, there were Armenians. It was a very cosmopolitan city of its day.
Yeah. Also a port city?
It is a port city, on the Black Sea. It's a warm water port. For the Soviets, that was very important as well. Jews are basically able to go there and live where they want to live, but they live in Jewish neighborhoods. And you see all types of Jewish societies forming, all types of Jewish organizations, various synagogues. I was in Odessa a number of years ago, and I took a Jewish history tour, and they showed us where even there was the port workers had their own synagogue down at the port.
So my wife went to Odessa and saw the dental school where her grandmother went to school.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
The building is still there, and it's being used for something else.
She
was from Nikolaev, and she went to dental school.
Was that in Tsarist times, or was that the Soviet times?
Yeah, no, it was Tsarist times.
So proves the point that Jews could do much more in Odessa than they could do elsewhere. She had to come to Odessa for that.
I think there was an associated trip with because it was a sister city.
Yes, yeah, and it still is. There's a lot of going back and forth between the two communities. Various Jewish professionals come here and visit there and what have you. Were you on a Jewish professionals trip there?
With the Associated.
With the Associated, okay. All right. So, after a few years in Odessa, he moved to Vienna. Vienna was the place where you went if you were a Jewish intellectual, where you were even doing too much for the Tsars in Odessa, where you really were going to push the boundaries. It also was a wealthier city. You had a better standard of living. You had more publishing going on there, and that was important for all these folks, too. He wrote for a Russian-language Jewish newspaper at first. Then he started his own newspaper. His newspaper was called, it was called Hashachar, which means the dawn. H-A-S-H-A-C-H-A-R, Hashachar. It's a very famous Hebrew newspaper. It was a monthly, so it was really a journal, I guess, more than anything else. And it was known for its intellectualism, And remember from what I said last hour, who was it geared toward?
Haskalah,
the Maskilim, of which there are, you know, still a number now, even though many of the Maskilim are starting to turn toward Zionism, they still have their own form of communication in these newspapers, because they still believe in everything that the Maskilim believed in, except for one thing. They didn't believe that you could integrate anymore, but they believed in education and secular topics, and what's called a historical approach to Judaism. Wissenschaft is the German terminology for it, the historical approach to Judaism, which was actually part of the founding ideology of the Reform movement as well. He writes a couple key essays. One's called Am Olam, or the worldly people. Another is called Et Lasot, what to do. I'm going to tick off what he said. He's convinced that Judaism is progressive and not reactionary, and he regarded Judaism as a matter of spirit. Not religion, but spirit. And how many times have we heard people say, I don't really like services, but I'm a spiritual person. Or I spiritually feel something, but I don't go for that organized type of stuff. It's not necessarily new. He said he called for the strengthening of spiritual forces and a national awareness to bolster self-respect. He said, we've lost our way. We don't take pride in being Jewish. We need to not be separate, but we need to be proud. He said Judaism is more than just religion. And this, by the way, goes in the face of Neo-Orthodoxy from Samson Raphael Hirsch and Reform Judaism. Because we don't often think of Reform Judaism in these terms, but classical Reform said that Judaism is only a religion. Right? You're loyal to the country you live in, but Judaism is only a religion. We're not a separate people. He still held out some hope. He said anti-Semitism can only be reversed by a reaffirmation of Jewish nationhood. So there's still a way out of it for him, at least at first. He's much more into nationalism at first than he is into Zionism. And he has a quote right here. This is from his biography, The Sins of Youth. Since we went into exile from the time our homeland was destroyed, and even in Alexandria in Egypt. Anybody know who was from Alexandria, the famous Jew?
Philo.
Maimonides was
from Spain.
Right, and then he wound up in the Fostat, the old city of Cairo. We have been foreigners. We've always been outsiders. Abandoned fondlings and uninvited guests. During the age of faith, we were foreigners in Europe because of religion. Now in the age of nationalism, we are foreign because of our ethnic origins. Very similar to Hess in many regards. We are Semites among Aryans. I kind of love that line. Children of Shem among children of Japheth, a Palestinian tribe in lands belonging to the peoples of Europe. Who would let a stranger into his home as if he were part of the family? So, he was a good writer, to say the least, and he could forcefully make his point. He wrote that in 1873. Like many, many others, the pogroms deeply impacted him. We see the turn. And he symbolizes this shift in Jewish thinking across the board. He said in his writings immediately after the pogroms, these are the first manifestations of worst horrors to come. So it's going to get worse. So you know he was shocked. The only real refuge is Eretz Yisrael. Emigration to America is no good because we can't preserve ourselves as a people in America. Those Jews who go to America are going to assimilate, and they're going to no longer be Jews. He was right for a number of Jews in America. So he wrote 25 different articles on the need to return to the homeland. And he said, industry as well as Torah and Hebrew knowledge will sustain us in the to be a cultured nation in our own homeland. Then he wrote, let us search our ways. Let's see if I have, and this is part of it. Let all special questions, whether religious or economic in nature, take second place to the general question, to the sole and simple aim that Israel be saved by the Lord with an everlasting salvation. Unite and join forces. Let us gather our dispersed from Eastern Europe and go up to our land with rejoicing. Whoever is on the side of God and his people, let him say, I am for Zion. Great publicist, great polemicist. People began to take notice when people such as he wrote such topics, and this was beginning to change the Maskilim and give voice to what they had to say and were thinking in this day and age. Our next thinker is Moshe Lieb Lilienbaum. Now that's a great beard, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
All these guys had great beards. We were joking earlier. We might as well play on the Red Sox, right?
Before you came in.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Lilienbaum was born in 1843 and died in 1910. And he lived in Lithuania. Let me get out of the way so you guys can see this. He was a traditional Jew. So he's a bridging both worlds. He was brilliant. He got married at age 15. At age 20, yeah, maybe he's not so bright. That's what I'm thinking. Maybe I shouldn't have juxtaposed them. At 23, he established a yeshiva in Lithuania. He wrote in Hebrew, Yiddish, and Russian. So he was a maskil. He studied medieval Jewish philosophy. He began publishing in the modern Hebrew press and became a maskil. At age 26, his heretical views had him denounced. So guess where he went? Odessa, because that was a good place to go. He began calling for changes in modern Jewish life. You know, he couldn't go back to the traditional world at this point. He lost faith in the Torah's divine nature. He actually said, I can't buy this story anymore. Began reading Russian literature, and he used its techniques in Hebrew literature and criticism. All right, he becomes a Zionist. In the 1870s, so he's a little early, he calls for the end of economic distress by transferring Jews to agricultural colonies in Russia. And there have been attempts to do this. And we're going to see there are attempts in Argentina to do this as well. Again, the pogroms put a Zionist belief fully into gear. And, you know, interestingly enough, it's very rarely for any of these folks that they basically say, I'm a Zionist because I believe in the Jewish people and we can be free in our homeland. It's all shaped by the outside. It's all shaped by anti-Semitism. He becomes a leader in something called Chovevei Tzion. We're going to talk in detail more about that in a little bit. But there's small chapters of Zionist-oriented Jews throughout Russia primarily. He calls for a new form of Jewish unity. He says, let all special questions, whether religious or economic in nature, take second place to the general question, to the sole and simple aim that Israel be saved by the Lord with an everlasting solution. So he's quoting from text. Remember, he's got this great background. Unite and join forces, let us gather our dispersed from Eastern Europe and go up to our land with rejoicing. Whoever is on the side of God and his people, let him say, I am for Zion. Did I just say that in the last one?
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I copied that. I think that was Lilienbaum. Sorry about that. My apologies there. So he was the great writer. What?
Hyde's form of flattery is plagiarism. Right. Plagiarism. You liked it so much, you repeated it.
I got a long career in plagiarism. Don't worry about that. All right. Lilienbaum also thought of Palestine a little differently than Smoleskine. He talks...
That's also...
You know what?
What?
Let's go on to Pinsker. Maybe I have better luck with him. Somehow that got copied. All right. Let me just one final note on Lilienbaum. Lilienbaum, after his writings, impressed the Maskilim in Odessa so much, became head of something called the Odessa Committee. And the Odessa Committee was really the head of Chovevei Tzion. It was formerly called the Society for the Support of Jewish Farmers and Artisans in Syria and Palestine. The reason why it had that formal name is it would have been against Russian law to promote a different form of nationalism. So you always had to try and skirt the law. And that's why these people were in and out of Russia. All right, let's go on to Leo Pinsker. Has anyone had a chance to read his essay, Self-Emancipation, or Auto-Emancipatia? Anything stand out to you? Or
if I remember correctly, he just cared that they leave Russia and go anywhere.
Right, yeah.
It
yeah.
wasn't like specifically go to the land of Israel.
Correct. He later starts to believe that, but the more important thing to think about, I think, is that by calling for self-emancipation, he was putting it to the Maskilim. He was saying that emancipation or Haskalah is not the goal. By taking on an agenda of Haskalah, you want to integrate into the environment of the non-Jews. We need to revitalize ourselves. We need to work on ourselves as a people. So it's a different philosophical approach to it. And that's really what he's known for as much as anything else. All right, let me tell you a little bit about Pinsker. He was born in 1821, and he died in 1891. So for all these folks, keep in mind that
That's old.
In those days, when a cut could kill you from infection, that's definitely old. But what all these guys had was a long career of ideology until they came to Zionism later in life because of their stages in life. He was born in a small Polish town. Unlike many, he grew up in Odessa, so he was weaned on this. He had a secular education. He went to the University of Odessa, or Odessa University, where he gained a degree in law. It's another one. It still works that way, too. Then he went to the University of Moscow for medicine. He was one of the first Jews to go to the University of Moscow for medicine, which shows you how intellectual he was. He became a prominent physician in Odessa, which he went back to, and he always took an active role in Jewish public affairs. In 1860s, he founded one of the first Russian Jewish newspapers. And again, in the pogroms of 1881, he was moved to consider mass emigration. By 1882, the pogroms, remember, were in 1881, and a little bit in 1882, he published Auto-Emancipatia, or Self-Emancipation. He wrote it in German. Why would he write it in German?
The intellectuals, right.
That's the intellectuals. Jews and non-Jews would hopefully read it in his view. He said emancipation wouldn't work. We need self-emancipation. He said Jews needed to be conscious of their history and what it means for their future. So he was wrapping together this Wissenschaft, the study of the past, in terms of what it means for the future, and his modern ideology. He said Jews were feared because they were different in history. So he tries to put a face to what the non-Jewish fear is. He said they once had a political model, but now they no longer have a political model, but yet they still survived. He referred to the Jewish nation as, quote, one of the dead walking among the living. And then later he'd say, this ghost-like appearance of a people without unity or organization, without territory or cohesion, no longer alive but wandering among the living, could not but make a unique, strange impression upon the imagination of the nations. And if the fear of ghosts is something unborn, why wonder that it turned up at the sight of this nation, dead but still alive? As long as we lack a home of our own like other nations have, we shall have to abandon the noble hope of being counted as human beings of equal worth. Again, writing to the people who are hopefully influencing others, because remember what Maskilim are. They're not just journalists, they're also teachers, they're schoolmasters, they're public policy people in terms of Jewish agencies and committees, wherever they are. Pinsker, again, was one of these names that made people stand up and notice. In theory, as you said, he didn't really care where the home would be for the Jewish people. He did, however, say that Palestine is the most sensible place to go, but basically we need to get out of here as quickly as we can. Those are our three early Russian Zionist thinkers. Any questions? No? Okay. Let's move on to Chibat Zion or Chobeve Zion. Let me write that up on the board. Very famous movement in early Zionist circles. No, not Skype. David, I'll call your son in Israel, Skype.
Okay.
It's the middle of the night.
Didn't you know he's home?
Yeah, that's right. We hope.
I'm not going to touch that. Yeah, my problem.
Chobeve Zion or Chibat Zion, the lovers of Zion. Or, those who appreciators. Hard word to transfer. If you ever heard the Hebrew word chabibi, it comes from the same root as that. I have a great picture that I want to show you. Oh, no, I couldn't get that transferred, actually. I spend a lot of time trying to find photos for you guys, but that one didn't work out. All right. Pinsker was chosen to preside over the first conference of Chovev Etzion. So Pinsker, in Odessa, the Odessa Committee, wasn't in Odessa. It was in Germany, in Katowice, Germany. The reason it was in Katowice, Germany was because the Russian government wouldn't allow nationalist organizations to have a foothold in their country because they didn't need other national groups to be inspired and revolt against them. So they created a central coordinating committee. Pinsker was the chair of it. It had three goals. Promote the idea of settlement in Palestine, number one. Help the settlers in any way they can, in terms of their preparation or what have you, and raise money to do all this. Raising money would be the thorn in the heel for Chovev Etzion, Chibat Zion. People still weren't fully committed, or enough people, and certainly the wealthy people were not committed to the Zionist movement. We're going to see in 2 weeks, Herzl spends a lot of time going around to wealthy Jews, and he basically gets fed up, and he says, fine, I'll do it without you, because they tell him, Baron Rothschild basically kicks him out of the house in Paris. In 1890 and 91, Chovev Etzion helped to found Rehovot and Hadera, which are towns today in Israel. Rehovot is a pretty big town now. Hadera is not as big, but it's beautiful.
Oh, Yemenite.
Which one?
Hadera.
No, not Gedera.
Hadera.
There's two different, they're very similar.
Yeah. Gedera, I actually know somebody who grew up on a moshav there.
Hadera is where the war thing is.
Right.
Three or four towers. Going.
Right. excuse me. In 1897, just before the Zionist Congress, the Odessa Committee had 4,000 members. So it was starting to become a popular movement, and they were primarily in Odessa itself. This was really the first, we'll call it large membership organization of the Zionist movement. I don't want to call it a mass membership organization of the Zionist movement. The Zionist Congress itself is going to take on that. They stay in existence until 1903, and then they merge into the World Zionist Organization, or the Zionist Organization as it's called at that time. Now, we come to my favorite part of the lecture. We get to talk about Baron Rothschild. And let's see. I'm going to turn the lights out. We're going to watch an 8-minute movie about him. Get a little background. It's a nice little break from listening to a lecturer. And actually, let's see.
הוא ראה עולם אחר לגמרי. הוא הסתכל קדימה. לא היה פה כלום. אבל היה חזון. הוא נשבע ביופיו של המקום. היה לו חזון, והוא הצליח. הוא עשה את הכל בשקט, בצניעות. לא בכדי, הוא נקרא אבי יישוב. אנחנו נכנסים פה בעצם לתוך ספר ההיסטוריה. העתיקה שלפני 200 שנה. האב, מאיר אמשל רוטשילד, היה ידוע כאיש עסקים ישר והגון. מספרים שלילה אחד דפק על דלתו הנסיך המקומי שחיפש מקום מסתור לארגזי הזהב שלו. זה היה מסוכן. הנסיך מודח מתפקידו, נאלץ לברוח מהמדינה, ורוטשילד, שהיה ידוע באמינותו, לקח את האוצר ושמר לו עליו. עברו שנים, והנסיך חזר. הוא הגיע לבית רוטשילד, וגילה להפתעתו שהכסף נשאר מטבע למטבע. היושר שהפגין רוטשילד הזקן בעסקה הזו נודע ברבים, ובית רוטשילד הפך לבית עסקים גדול. רוטשילד כינס את חמשת בניו הבוגרים בערוב ימיו, ואמר להם, אני מציע לכם להתפזר בעולם, אבל תעשו עסקים ביחד. תסמכו אחד על השני, ולא יהיה גבול להצלחה שלכם. תחשבו על חמישה חיצים. כל חץ אפשר בקלות לשבור אותו. את חמשת החיצים יחד קשה מאוד לשבור. ובסמל של משפחת רוטשילד, שישנו פה בשער, עם חמשת החיצים, אלה חמשת האחים. ושלוש המילים, קונקורדיה, אחדות, אינדוסטריה, חריצות. ואינטגריטס, קדושה, מייצגות את הערכים של בית רוטשילד. הרוטשילדים פרסו כנפיים, חמשת הבנים, הקימו סניפים בלונדון, בפריז, בווינה, בפרנקפורט ובנאפולי. אלה היו מרכזים פיננסיים. האמונה ברוטשילדים עברה כמו גלים ולהדף לכל אירופה. השם של רוטשילד בהדרגה הפך להיות לשם של אמינות, וידם הייתה בכל העסקים הגדולים של העולם. בין הסכונים של הפמן הצרפתי ג'יימס היה אדמונד, והוא גדל בשיא העושר הצרפתי של המאה ה-19. האחים הגדולים שלו כבר היו בעסקים, במסחר. הוא לא נחשב איש עסקים. הוא נחשב לאספן, לאמנות, היה לו יקב. הוא היה באריסטוקרטיה של יהדות צרפת. הוא היה במקום הכי גבוה שיכול להיות. איך הוא מגיע לעניין הזה של ארץ ישראל? איך הוא נשאר בו 50 שנה? ארץ ענייה, לא כבישים, לא חשמל, לא תחבורה, מעט מאוד אנשים. ואז המושבות הן מובריות לגמרי. חקלאות מאוד מאוד פרימיטיבית. מציאות של מלאריה, מציאות של במשך שנה 10% מהאנשים מתו. זה מה שהיה פה בישראל. ובאירופה היו הרבה יהודים שהחלום שלהם זה להגיע לישראל, אבל רובם עניים, קשה היה להם להתפרנס, קשה לחיות.
הגיעים אז אירופה עוד לרוסיה, והברון רוטשילד חשב שהדרך האחרונה היא קודם כל לעזור ליהודים סובלים.
ואז הגיעה משלחת מיהודי ארץ ישראל אל הברון רוטשילד בפריז לבקש עזרה, והברון, הנדיב הידוע, מחליט לעשות מעשה.
הוא לא התכוון להיכנס לאותה הרפתקה שהוא נכנס אליה. זה היה הדרגתי.
הוא לא חזר שהוא הולך להיות האבא של ההתיישבות כולה בארץ ישראל. הוא התחיל בקטן. הוא התחיל בתמיכה במספר מושבות.
ודי מהר מצא את עצמו מעורב עד האוזניים.
מראש פינה בצפון ועד גדרה בדרום, הברון רוטשילד קנה אדמות כדי להקים עליהן מושבות. המקצועיות של החקלאים המתיישבים הראשונים הייתה מאוד דקויה, לכן שלח להם נושאים מקצועה.
לקח שנה לבנות את זכרו. בתקופה הטורקית, בימים ההם, שאין מכוניות ואין בולדוזרים ואין טרקטורים, והדבר הכי גבל שישנו בשטח זה גמר, הם דבשת. בנו מושבה לתפארת. איזה בתים יפים. בית כנסת יחיד במינו. יתר, גנים. הייתה פה עשייה, עשייה גדולה.
והוא לא רוצה פרסום, הוא מוכן לעשות הרבה, רק להזכיר את שמו. לכן קוראים לו הנדיב הידוע.
הוא נתן עם כל הלב לכל המושב שלו.
ומספרים עליו שהוא היה באמת מטורף על כל הראש בענייני ארץ ישראל.
היה לו חדר מיוחד עם כל המפות של ארץ ישראל. הוא היה שוכב על הארץ כדי לראות יותר טוב את המפה שהיה מבוגר יותר. אז הדבקות שלו בזה הלכה וגדלה, האהבה שלו הלכה וגדלה יותר ויותר.
ב-1934, הברון רוטשילד נפטר בצרפת. בצוואתו הוא ביקש להיקבר בישראל, אבל הוא לא אמר איפה. ובעצם הבן שלו, ג'יימס, היה צריך לפענח את החידה. ג'יימס בחר את הגבעה התרשית הזו ליד זיכרון, כי הברון היה קשור למושבה זיכרון יעקב ואהב את הנופים החשופים שמסביב. מהמקום הזה אפשר לראות לא רק את הים, אלא גם את המפעלים השונים של הברון בסביבה הקרובה.
זה לא שהברון המציג לא עניין אותי. פשוט ראיתי שזה מקום עניין אותי יותר. לא רק כמו זה, פלש כזה, פלש כמו קאובוי כזה. אז זה גם ככה.
את הגן הקימו משפחת רוטשילד, לזכרו של הנדיב הידוע, הברון רוטשילד. גן זיכרון, כן, מקום עצוב, אבל למעשה גן פורח, שמח. הרעיון היה לא רק להביא למנוחת עולמים את הברון, אלא בו זמנית ללמד פרק בהיסטוריה, לראות איך עושים גן יפה בתנאים של ארץ ישראל, ולאפשר מקום למחקר וללימוד. זאת אומרת, כל המקום הזה הוא מלא פנים.
אף פעם לא ראיתי
גן
כזה ענק ויפה ומלא פנים.
אני
חושבת שהוא
מיוחד. הגן הוא בעצם אוסף של גנים קטנים ושונים, שכל אחד עם סיפור משלו. גן הוורדים הוא אירופה בהתגלמותה, גן הוורדים קלאסי. גן התקלים אוספים תקלים מכל העולם, כדי שמי שמבקר כאן יוכל לראות דברים באוסטרליה ומאפריקה. יש גן ריחות שמיועד בעיקר לאנשים שלא רואים טוב, שיהנו גם הם. יש גם בפנמיים, גם בדורה, בסגנון ים תיכוני, זורם.
That's all it gave us. Anyway, that's a little background on Baron Rothschild. Let's see, there we go. I was afraid the lights wouldn't come on for a second there. All right, so there's a nice picture of the Baron. Ah, there was a nice picture of the Baron.
Did his other four brothers who were older also get attached to Israel and give charity to Israel?
He was the one who was the philanthropist in the family, so he was designated to do that on behalf of the Rothschild family. I'm sure they had other philanthropic works, but nothing like him. Not even close.
So there were five brothers plus him, or he was...
No,
he
had other brothers. Actually, I don't know if he had four other brothers. But he was the grandson or the great-grandson?
Great-grandson.
Yeah.
He was the five original brothers.
The five brothers, he was the son.
Great-grandson.
Of one of the brothers.
Of the
original.
Of the father.
I'm not good with that stuff.
It was the great-grandson of Meyer.
It was the father, and then there were five sons. They were the five Aarons. They went all over.
Don't you remember
right.
the movie from the 40s?
Well, the Rothschild family is a great history, and it's definitely worth. There's many books on the Rothschild family, so I'd recommend if you're interested taking a look at one of them. So let me tell you a little more about this Baron Rothschild. They're all Baron Rothschilds, by the way, but this is Edmund D. Rothschild. He was born in 1845, and he died in 1934. So he too had a good long life. He was of the French part of the family. He was born in Paris. He served in the French army. He didn't shirk that obligation, as I'm sure he could have if he wanted to. He inherited vineyards, and as we know, France has some pretty good vineyard territory there. Gets a good form of volcanic ash there. He took little active role in the family business of banking. It just didn't interest in him. Philanthropy interested him. And he had enough in terms of the vineyards that he was able to be a great philanthropist. I don't think any Rothschild is going to starve, and he certainly wasn't going to. He pursued artistic and philanthropic interests. He founded scientific institutes. He funded archaeological digs. He was a guy who liked travel. He was interested in the world. He purchased a lot of art. Listen to this. He purchased 40,000 engravings, 3,000 drawings, more than 100 of them were from Rembrandt, and he gave them all to the Louvre. So that's a pretty nice philanthropist, to say the least. In Palestine, by the end, he was estimated to have spent $50 million on the settlements. Now, that was from roughly 1891 to, 1934, 35. I can't imagine how much that is today. Yeah?
What's one of the big things that he actually purchased the land, right? I mean, he was.
Yes, he had his agents purchase the land.
Was a pretty big deal, I guess.
He also came and rescued some existing settlements that were floundering financially. He's more known for that than for starting settlements, but he did start some settlements as well. Because to start settlements, you need something very important, which is what?
People's land.
People. Right, you need the people, and they weren't really coming in mass. The first wave of immigrants that came to Israel, you know, 70-80% of them stayed in the cities. A couple of them went to Jerusalem, not many, because remember, there aren't really many neighborhoods outside of the walls of the old city right now, and they're primarily all for Haredi Jews, or the Orthodox Jews. They're in Jaffa. Haifa's a small little community, but they're in, you know, not really Bethlehem, but Hebron or Hebron, Beersheba, but mainly in Jaffa. And then we're going to talk about the second Aliyah. We're going to see how they create the city of Tel Aviv, the people who live in Jaffa. That comes in 1909, but hey, that's way ahead of our story in terms of where we're at. All right. He, too, is affected by the pogroms of 1881 and starts thinking about the settlements. So he turns to buying some land in Palestine. He financed the Rishon LeZion settlement. Rishon LeZion has a great vineyard, has a great wine factory, if anybody's ever been there. I remember at age 19 sampling wine one afternoon there, probably one or two many. But it was, I still remember it, so it couldn't have been too many. He saw the settlements as an interesting place for experimentation with agriculture, for agricultural techniques, as well as new machinery. So it wasn't just the Zionist thing for him. The kind of forward-thinking individual that he was, he saw this as a place of experimentation. So he was interested on many levels on the well-being of the settlements. By 1890, his agents were managing 9 of the 13 settlements in the land of Israel. So remember, by 1890, there's only 13 settlements. This gives you an indication, by the way, of how quickly Zionism grows and how much it builds. You know, I remember one of my first trip to Israel with my wife, my new wife at that point. I met my new brother-in-law, and we were driving around one day, and I said, "Oh, there are cranes over there, Ophir. Are they building something?" And he said, "Neil, in Israel, they're always building." That's what I'm sure you saw a lot there. Right, and...
National bird.
What?
That's the national bird.
The crane? Yeah, I've never heard that, but that's a good one. But it begins in this era, you know, from 1881 to 1890, only 9 years, there are 13 settlements. That really gets a footprint on the ground and is going to lay the groundwork for more to come, because for the waves of immigration that are going to come. Baron Rothschild has some tension with the settlers. You would imagine and understand that Baron Rothschild is used to getting his way. And if you read some of the letters in the Penciler book, and I think I have an excerpt of it because it's just so good.
he's a businessman.
I don't know if he's a businessman or if he's just used to having his way, because he doesn't have a strong background in business, from what we know.
Well, he invests money.
He invests.
And he wants to make sure he gets some return on his investment.
And he wants his type of return. He doesn't necessarily want a return on his investment, because let me give you a quick example.
His return is success.
Yes. But let me give you an example. The type of philanthropist that he is, you know, he has a lot of these Zionists. He tells them, you have to go out and grow grapes, and my agents will tell you which grapes to grow. And you plant them, and he has agents living there and watching over them and checking their spending and all that. Well, they would grow the wrong grapes. They couldn't make wine out of it. But one year, they grew a lot of grapes, and they made a lot of wine, and they just couldn't sell it in Europe. So he bought something like 30,000 bottles of wine. Right now, he didn't need 30,000 bottles of wine, but he bought it to make sure that they would continue to be financially independent. So in many regards, it was a false sense of living. These early communities, the settlements, they weren't succeeding on their own. They couldn't yet succeed on their own. You had a bunch of these Eastern European immigrants planted in the desert, told to grow grapes. You know, they had no idea what was going on. But the Baron would send his people, and they would revolt and write back and forth and what have you. Let's take a look. But so he sets up, I just mentioned, the wine industry, which is now the Israeli wine industry. There's a different wine industry now, too, because of the Golan Heights. you know, the joke is they really don't want to give up the Golan Heights because of the wine. And, you know, that's a pretty, you know, Golan and, you know, some other stuff that, hopefully you've had an opportunity to taste. Rishon LeZion and Zichron Yaakov. Those are two places where he sets up vineyards. He also tries wine in Petach Tikva, Hadera, and Rosh Pina. By 1895, there are all the way up to 30 settlements in the land of Israel now. And after the state is established, by the way, he owns these settlements. He gives all the land of the settlements to the state. Right? In Israel, the government owns the vast majority of the land through the Israel Lands Authority. You rent your land from the government. It's a very complicated system, which irritates a lot of people, particularly when they come from the West. But it's the system that they have.
China,
I don't know much about. All right, let me take a look. Here's his great letter, which some of you hopefully have read. His letter back to the settlers. The settlers wrote to him complaining, we don't like what your overseers are doing. We're not free to live our socialist dream the way we want to live our socialist dream, and we need change. We really appreciate your money, but you're going about it all wrong. I kind of love his language. I'm writing to you personally because I'm displeased and angry with you. We know where he stands. You are the kind of Jews whom God deemed unworthy to enter the Holy Land, and whom he left to die in the desert. You are not worthy of my munificence. If you do not mend your ways, and if you do not satisfy me completely very shortly, you will no longer exist for me. You know the expression, you're dead to me? The kids say that all the time. And I shall transfer my benefaction to others of whom there is no shortage. I want to support workers, not beggars. If you don't work properly, I will abandon you. You must obey my representatives to the letter. Well, this, in some regards, is a pattern that we're going to see in big givers, right, down to the present day. Certain big givers are going to have it their way, no matter what way it might be. But yet, on the flip side of the coin, they fund the show and they get things done. So there was tension going on, which is going to continue until this day, between the funders in the diaspora and the people in the state of Israel. Any of you are involved in Jewish organizations, you might have heard of that. You've heard of this? Somewhat. You've heard of this? Somewhat. All right. So let's talk about this, too. I found this report on the Jewish Telegraphic Agency archives. The Baron came to Israel in 1925. It was one of a number of trips that he made. As Joe was saying, he made five trips, I think you said. And he stayed there, you know, when you traveled in these days, you didn't just, particularly if it was 1900, before airplanes and what have you, you didn't just go for a week. You stayed sometimes a month, 2 months, 3 months, what have you. What?
There were no real roads.
There was a railroad by this point between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, though, if you wanted to go up and see the really wretched state of Jerusalem at this point. So, it's quite nice. He was received on landing by Jewish and Arab horsemen who escorted him to Zichron Yaakov, the colony which he has said is dearest to him because it is named in memory of his father, and in the synagogue, he always built a synagogue in his settlements. Even though some of these people were socialists, most of them came from traditional backgrounds. He received the colonists of all the Rothschild colonies and the representative of the principal Jewish organizations in the country. Sir Herbert Samuel, who was the British High Commissioner, was among those present, and in his speech he said that the Baron's visit was a great event in the history of Palestine, for the Baron was the benefactor of Jews and Arabs alike. Mr. Nachum Sokolov, the new president of the Zionist organization, who was also there, expressed to the Baron on behalf of the Jews of Palestine and the whole world the feelings of love and admiration in which he is held. All shops were closed, and the day was observed as a general holiday. And then it goes on. Baron Edmund D. Rothschild funded the Zionist enterprise before there was a Zionist organization. He was the guy, and he never let his name be known. He didn't want it known, even though everybody knew his name personally, but he was known in Hebrew as Hanadiv HaYadua, the known benefactor, right, which is kind of strange. But you see also in the Penciler Kaplan book, some of the letters, if you read from the women in there, they talk about the Baron in their letters. So word is out, obviously. But this was the Baron's peculiar desire, so they adhered to it. But did any of you get to read the letters from the women? Yeah, they were quite good. Yeah, they were quite good. It really gives you a different window into life. What it also shows you, by the way, it's one of the things that doesn't come out a lot, is that while there are socialist immigrants in this first wave, there are many religious Jews who are moving to the land of Israel, too. They have bought into this concept of, we talked about Kalisher and Alkali, that this will help bring the Messiah. This will help, you know, set the groundwork for that. Many religious people came to the land of Israel in the first wave in particular. After that, we're going to get primarily socialists, or, you know, by the time you get to the 1930s, you get German shopkeepers who are fleeing for obvious reasons from 33 to 38 when they can get out. All right, the Baron died in 1934, and he goes down in history as a very, very important person. And I'll tell you, by watching that video, it made me think, I've actually, on all my trips to Israel, I've never been to the Baron's Gardens. And I really would like to see that. What? Yeah. Have you been there?
Spectacular.
Yeah, it sounds spectacular. Where is it? Zichron Yaakov?
I think.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I don't remember if they said it there or not.
That's a nice little town to visit, too.
Yeah, I've been there. I've been there. I've just never been to the garden.
A little bit of that video showed this main street down the middle.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a nice video. There's a lot of stuff out there. All right, let's see. Let's touch on one more thing. We're going to touch on the Bilu, B-I-L-U-E. And that comes from a phrase in the Tanakh, Beit Yaakov Nilchu Nilchu, the house of Jacob will go up. Let me write it on here. Bilu. And let me see if I have a photograph of them for you. Hopefully I do. Let me switch back and forth. Oh, this is the Bilu Manifesto. You guys can read that while I'm talking. This is the very arrogant, demanding note to the Jewish world that you would expect 18 and 19-year-old ideologues to write. As this is written, by the way, when they're in Turkey, I think they're in Istanbul on their way to the land of Israel, because they had to stop there first. They were trying to get certain permits or what have you. There were 14 of them. All right. Obviously, people are starting to leave Eastern Europe at this time, primarily for America. A handful are going to go to the land of Israel. The Bilu are 14 young adults, and they are the first group of secular Jews that move to Palestine, the land of Israel. They're from Kharkov in the Ukraine, K-H-A-R-K-O-V, which is still a large city there today. They are influenced by a former Jew named Karl Marx. They want to live on that socialist, utopian community. None of them had farming experience. Not one. Only one of them, by the way, would have lived to see the State of Israel in 1948. Now, keep in mind, that's some 60 years later, almost. A number of them would go back, or about half of them would go back to Europe after a while, after half a year or whatever. They come to an area, they have land there, the land has rocks, it's not arable at all, there's no water, it's an extremely difficult challenge. They first come to Mikveh Israel, which is the Jewish farming school that who set up, anyone remember? The Alliance in 1870. So all of a sudden, the Alliance farming school is helping not just the people who were already living there and making them quote-unquote useful, but Jews who are immigrating there and want to change the world. They join the Chovavet Zion settlers in establishing Rishon LeZion as an agricultural cooperative. They purchased the land from an adjacent Arab village. Now, land purchase is going to become an extremely contentious issue in the creation of the State of Israel, and it remains that way today, because a lot of the land was owned by absentee landlords. They might have been in Turkey, they might have been in Saudi Arabia, they might have been somewhere else, and you might have gone to those people, wherever they were, and bought land and come back and said to the people who were farming that land for 200 or 300 years, this is no longer your land, get out of here. And that's part of what has led to the clash initially between the Arabs and the Jews in the land of Israel today. They were plagued by water shortages, by illnesses, by lack of experience. and by debt. Nothing went their way. It's extremely difficult. They turned to who?
Rothschild.
Baron Rothschild. Daddy Warbucks of his day. They turned to Baron Rothschild. He provided funding that led to the establishment of a winery. I guarantee you these good socialist young adults weren't interested in setting up a winery. But nonetheless, they did, and they persisted. Six of them at that point went back to the Ukraine. This was about a year into the experience. 1884, another group of Belu came. I couldn't find exactly how many. It's about a dozen. They went on to found Gedera, which we talked about, which is where a lot of Yemenites would wind up. Again, the land's purchased from a nearby Arab village. And by the way, you know, the Arabs are saying, you want that piece of land? We haven't been able to farm that for hundreds of years. Go for it. Well, they probably regret that today. They ate radishes and potatoes to survive, which they bought from the Arabs, because they were doing business with people who were there. They had to deal with Arab marauders, which was beginning to become a problem. Rothschild went, the great capitalist, went and saved these Marxists as well. So we're having a clash of ideologies here, which led to the letter. At the peak, the Bilumim had about 60 members in the mid-1880s in Israel. It was a small group in Kharkov, but they were the first ones who did anything. They also were the prototype for the kibbutzim, their communities. Now, we're not going to see the first kibbutz until about 1915 or so. But these guys, and that was in response to other things as well, but these guys set up the whole model. So why were they significant? I'll close on that note. This marks the beginning of the modern Zionist settlement in the land of Israel. So today, we've had ideologues talking about it. We've had people saying, yes, we should all go en masse to the land of Israel, which, you know, Herzl's going to come along eventually and say, that's crazy. The land can't take you. We have to build it up first and what have you. Again, it's the first time that Jews are going to the land of Israel for secular reasons and not for religious ones. They're not going there just to die. They're going there to live. Many people, including Alkali, went to the land of Israel to die. As a movement, like I said, they failed. Right? At best, they had 60 people there in about 3 or 4 years. But they were the first ones to do anything. And if you get a chance, I can't remember what town it's in. Next time you're in Israel, and, you know, particularly if you go back next year for the GA or whatever, is it in Israel again? Every 5 years.
Going with you next year.
That's right. There's a museum of the first Aliyah in Israel, which I click through about 10 or 15 references to it on the internet, hoping that someone would give me a picture of the first Aliyah. But they all have the same picture of the building from the outside, and I just wasn't interested in that building, which was opened in like 1999 or something like that. All right, so tonight, what have we done? We have finished up our precursors to Zionism. We have dealt with the tremendous impact of the pogroms. And we have finally gotten to people moving to the land of Israel for modern Zionist reasons. When we meet again in 2 weeks, we're going to talk about Herzl and Nordau. If you have a chance, please read Alte Neue Land. You'll find it goes pretty quickly. It's an easy book to read. Yeah, a couple other things to read too, but that would be great if you could read that. Any questions on anything? Okay, thank you very much. Early happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
And Hanukkah.
And Hanukkah, yeah.